Pizza Noir by Denver Day, Book 1, Chapter 7. MCSO and Phoenix PD got back to Lopez to report that the skater girl who was killed in San Diego, Jessica Roller, had no criminal history at all. Not out of Arizona, nor California, or anywhere else. She shared an address with two teammates, Becca Roller, also 31, formerly Becca Ray, and Veronica Roller, 42, formerly Veronica Martinez, and also formerly a Navajo Nation DPS officer. Becca Ray had spent 3 years with the Arizona Department of Corrections following a DV incident on her 22nd birthday that resulted in her shooting and killing her boyfriend in their Scottsdale apartment. That afternoon, both Becca and Veronica were back and accounted for in Phoenix on or about attending Jessica's funeral. Both Veronica and Becca were present when Jessica died, and both gave witness statements that were vague and inconclusive. Becca Roller attested she was in the restroom when it went down. Veronica Roller attested she was beating up on some guy who had called Jessica Roller a hooker with a pool cue when her friend received her death blows. And she said she turned around from her busy work to see Jessica already having been caved into the floor. It's not unusual to have this sort of general forensic disarray when there's a barroom brawl gone too far south. The facts from Lopez in San Diego included several other witness statements. Some of the girl's friends and teammates and staff and onlookers were at hand. They'd made no arrests nor officially named any suspects. It was just a brawl at a sharp-edged roadhouse out on the freeway, and one of those lady skaters got her skull squashed. Nobody saw anything specific before or after the dust cleared. Helpful, anyway. Jessica Roller, 31, formerly Jessica Ollander of Phoenix. Several of her teammates, several skaters from other teams, and several of the girls and boys working at the place were bloody, black, and blue, but their statements were all pretty muddy. Lopez also faxed me a Bloody Roller's roster. He noted that any list of the staff at the Roadhouse didn't really exist because it primarily comprised freelancers. And the barkeep, dancers, and waitstaff were all taken care of strictly on a four-tips on the fly cash basis. If it involved currency at all. The general consensus was of a quickly escalating dust-up followed by general confusion among a crowd followed by the fast flight of everybody involved except Jessica and her teammates. Illustrating further forensic entropy and disarray, the two dancers who went missing out of the San Diego club on October 11th disappeared from a different bar in a different part of town. I disseminated a memo to the other agencies advising of the teleconference set for the following day. Lopez spent much of his Monday evening researching the travel logistics among the skate circuits superimposed upon the geography of the October 11 killings. If those killings were some sort of retribution for the Roller homicide, it was a pretty obtuse blowback to target a group of people who shared nothing more than a certain loose demographic affiliation with whoever might have killed Roller the week before. I briefed McKinney regarding my convo with Detective Lopez. He sent me a case file summary for the Jessica Roller homicide. Nobody saw anything. I said, he's communicating with the Bloody Roller Squad's hometown handlers in Maricopa County. Lopez, also the two girls missing out of the San Diego disappeared from a different bar. And as far as anyone knows, they weren't at the Roadhouse when the skater was killed originally or ever. And he suggested Lopez did a teleconference tomorrow among the agencies involved from Arizona and along the coast. I said to the lieutenant, what did the Seattle Bureau have to say? Lieutenant answered, told us to keep them abreast of how things go and of any breaks in the case. I let them know about the San Diego lead so they can query their databases before tomorrow's funner. McKinney answered, would you mind getting another barometer reading out of the local jungle tonight? I don't mind. About 6 o'clock, the coroner's office phone, the consensus, Dixie said, included just some general circumstantial stuff in addition to the common locations and demographics already apparent. Mainly, that all the death blows, whether by gunshot wound or blunt force or blade or poison, were all succinct, competent, quick, and successful. Beyond that, there was nothing much new, she said. It's pretty clear that there are right now very many very effective perpetrators on the loose. And watch out for a repeat, Ricky, she warned. It was dusky and drizzling when I left the office. The possibility of a second act was dark because of the ease and stealth associated with the darkness of Saturday morning's affair. For now, a repeat seemed the best chance for any investigative break, though that's admittedly pretty dark thinking, I thought to myself. When I walked into the diner next door for a bite, Joe was in there cheating on himself, drinking the slightly thicker and slightly hotter coffee that the diner has to offer. Paired with his, I joined him at the bar and ordered scrambled eggs and iced tea, and we shot the shit about the case and the weather. There was more rain in the forecast. The waitress brought my eggs and tea and refilled Joe's cup. She smiled at us. I watched her turn and hang an order on the ticket wheel in the expediter's window with a click. Outside, an ambulance siren came and went. The front page of the newspaper was filled with election clutter, and the sports page discussed the nearing and unavoidable end of baseball season. Joe worked the crossword, and after about an hour's downtime, I headed for MC's Ale House. It was getting to be about half past eight. The fleshy, glossy brunette on the front of the building winked under the glowing neons and black lights. And the parking lot contained mostly chrome two-wheelers, as usual. I nodded at Alvarez, who was holding court at the end of the bar. The pool tables were all occupied. The house music was potted up much louder than its daytime volume that I'd experienced previously. The place wasn't jam-packed, but it was bustling, and the waitresses all wore uniforms similar to the one painted on the girl painted on the front of the building. Mascara moles, red bows, black fishnet stockings, and pleated skirts. Short ones. I sat down and ordered an ale. The girls were working as waitresses, not dancers. This wasn't even so much as a topless club. Girls didn't reek of doom or foreboding therewith. The air of the club seemed breathable, almost crisp, and the waitresses were clear-eyed, and the patrons were more interested in their conversations and pool games instead of just constantly snorkeling up train dust. The barkeep poured me a stout, and I asked him if he'd noticed anything unusual since Saturday morning's incident over at the Squeeze Box Club. No, but anybody of or related to the local stripping racket had to be concerned, he observed out loud. I informed him that there were other strippers slash dancers killed on the same night in cities all along the west coast from Vancouver down to San Diego. I watched the sports news playing on the big screen hanging behind the bar for a while. I stood up, left cash on the bar, and headed for the door to make my way to the Squeeze Box next. Alvarez nodded again as I made my way out. It was flat out raining hard when I got back outside, and it was about 9:45 when I pulled into the parking lot of the Squeeze Box. Unlike MC's, it was not bustling. The bartender was working by herself with only one barback on hand, who was rustling boxes about in the back of the house. Boxes and bottles. There weren't any patrons near the stage and nobody on the stage, and the house music was hushed. A small group huddled around drinks at the end of the bar, also occasionally gathering up at their sports news on their hanging TV. She explained that on Monday nights, the barkeep did. The club was basically just a dimly lit swinging door tavern with not enough crowd or demand for the full-fledged Babylon expected on busier nights of the week. Time was, she said, though, they weren't open on Mondays at all. I asked if she'd heard anything interesting about Saturday morning's killings. Well, I'm one of the managers, and it's been business as usual for the last 3 days, detective, she said. But Carrie Anders phoned me today, tells me you're investigating some other ones. And I gave her my card. I watched her eyes when she talked, looked at her face. She was sharp, wary, wry, attractive, and slightly withered. Wise with respect to her station in life. Do you have any contacts with her, or have you heard from any of the other incident locations up and down the coast? I asked her. Well, it's been 3 days. Word does travel through the grapevine, but I don't get out much. I don't have any sister wives in any of those cities, nor here in Tacoma as far as that goes, she said. What do you think about Anders? I asked her. Well, she's not up on the stage splitting atoms. An addict and a stripper, and probably not long for this world one way or the other, most of them aren't, she said. But I really don't think she's made of the stuff required to chop people up. She's too adrift. But it is true that she doesn't know any better than to hang out with losers. Okay. She came by her statement honest enough. "We'll be cautious and vigilant around here, please. Nobody's made any arrest yet," I said. I stood, tipped my hat, looked at the group at the far end of the bar, not recognizing any of them. The rain had let up somewhat temporarily as I walked to the car. There were just a few vehicles and nobody but me in the parking lot. I pulled out of the lot and headed toward my next stop, drove past the airlock motel on the way to the diddler on the roof, which was not slumbering like the squeeze box was on this Monday night. It was a different doorman than my last visit here, but the guy had similar style and asked the same cover charge for a Monday even. This club was working dancers on a Monday, in fact, though it was not the jam-packed coke den I had encountered on Saturday night. And the acts weren't rotating through the stripper pier as rapidly. It was more of an after-work businessman crowd rather than a full-barreled Saturday night shit show. And I enjoyed another pint and watched one of the girls' acts, a redhead wearing baby blue. I didn't recognize her. I told the bartender it seemed a decent crowd for a Monday. "Show must go on, detective. You guys arrest anybody yet?" he asked me. "Nope, you hearing any scuttlebutt?" I asked him. "Only that it didn't happen only here," he said. "We've got our heavy lifting staff working extra hours and more closely watching the girls and the safe and the like, keeping an eye on the doors, you know." From there, I headed across the street to the motel for some jazz. It was about 11. By then, I ordered a soda and a whatever the lady with the sax wanted. And I waved to the band who were riding out a harried fusion piece when I got there. The horns were good, and they circulated a warm wind in the room. She came over when the number ended, holding the drink that I'd sent her. "You think they could do without you for the rest of the night?" I smiled at her. "They might," she smiled back. "You hungry?" she asked me. And we worked on our drinks. The lounge didn't contain the mayhem as it had during my previous visit, either. We drank up, she packed up her horn, and we went to the nearby drive-thru burger place. A slightly rained-on girl hung our slightly rained-on cheeseburgers and sodas from my driver's side window, and we sat there and listened to the drizzling traffic, eating our midnight burgers. She said the band had nothing to report, and I told her about the lead out of San Diego. I suggested she might ask her bandmates if they'd seen any emo riot skate derby girls hanging around looking fishy, aside from the ones that just served us of burgers. "Will do," she said. We finished our late dinner and I drove her to her apartment. She asked me up for a nightcap. We listened to the rain and then the radio while we shared a bottle of Pinot Grigio and screwed on her couch and fell asleep sharing the wet spot.